Hi, I'm Josephine Ensign, author of Skid Road, On the Frontier of Health and Homelessness in an American City, and Way Home, Journeys Through Homelessness. For the past 40 years, I've worked as a nurse practitioner providing primary care to people experiencing poverty and homelessness. I have the lived experience of homelessness as a young adult. I live and work in Seattle, a city with our nation's third highest number of people experiencing homelessness. Only New York City and Los Angeles have higher numbers. The Skid Road podcast aims to amplify a diversity of voices about homelessness in the Seattle area. Beginning in 2015, when a state of emergency was declared for homelessness in our city and county, I've done a series of oral history interviews with local people living and working at the intersection of health and homelessness. Public health nurses, emergency department physicians, politicians, heads of nonprofit agencies, activists, and frontline staff. People who have not only endured homelessness, but who are now housed and are working on creative solutions to homelessness. I've learned a lot from my conversations with all of these people, and I want to share their insights with you. On a semi-weekly basis, I'll post a new podcast episode featuring these conversations, interspersed with some of my own reflections. Learn more about this project through my website at josephineensign.com. Please subscribe to this podcast and share it with others. Thanks for listening. So, Josephine Ensign, and here today on Wednesday, the 1st of July, 2015, with Crystal Koop. And this is for the Skid Road Project. And Crystal, again, this is a project to increase the understanding of the complexity of charity care, charity health care in King County, and kind of specifically Seattle. And so I am just going to go ahead and lead off with a question and let you go from there. But what led you to the work that you're doing?
So it's kind of a long, convoluted road. I was homeless as a teen and from the age of 12 to 14 in Alaska. And in Anchorage, well, actually, I think Alaska period, there's one youth shelter, and it's Covenant House, Alaska. So I left my house for a lot of just alcoholism, abuse, other dysfunction, and took off and couch surfed and slept in alleyways and things for almost a year there. Fortunately, it was summertime in Alaska. And then ended up at Covenant House due to being picked up by cops and things like that, and was then put into the Child Protective Service system. I ended up being one of the kids that sort of fell through the cracks there. It was supposed to be an emergency overnight, and then things were supposed to move on my case to get me rehomed or reunited or whatever. And they forgot. I ended up staying at that shelter for a year. And calling CPS on my own, going, where am I supposed to be? Is anybody working? And through that time, I had three or four different social workers, and none of them knew me, and I didn't know them. We didn't even know each other's names. But on paper, it looked like I had a bunch of social workers. So around then was the time where it was like, this doesn't work. and I would really like to be a person that I needed at that time, to follow through and communicate and let people know, give people clarity and help them navigate what is going on. Because the people that you're helping, there's probably some sort of traumatic situation going on. So help them, support them in that. So that was kind of my drive. Ended up in California, stayed there. Did my undergraduate there, and then I worked for an attorney, a defense attorney who was really great. He took hard cases. He took a lot of cases. He had a private practice, and But he also, the way he treated his clients, it was very individualized. It was like, tell me about your situation and your story. Like, the more I know, the better I can advocate for you. So that's where advocacy showed up. I was like, okay, this is how you can advocate for people. There's a strategy and a style to do that, and that's important. It's a skill set.
And you had told me earlier that you got your undergraduate at San Jose State in criminal justice.
In criminal justice.
So this was after you graduated.
It was my senior year internship.
Oh, cool.
to do my undergrad.
Yeah.
Kind of an interesting story on how I found that. Little sidebar. I had applied for like community corrections and probation, and I had to do a lie detector test and all this different stuff. And one of the questions, lie detector test. And one of the questions was, had I ever smoked hash? And the answer was yes, of course. And that barred me. You could not ever have smoked hash and worked at the probation department. So I was like, uh-oh, now I need an internship like yesterday. What do I do? So I went through the phone book and just called defense attorneys and did like a two-minute voicemail of like, this is me, this is what I'm doing, this is what I'm looking for. Call me back if you could use that. And Charles Smith, this defense attorney there in California, called me back
nice.
And said, I like your tenacity, and I went to San Jose State as well, so come on down. But he was just an excellent advocate and used the litigation skills that he had, but also actually it wasn't just a craft or a contest. Like, he actually gave a shit about the people that were his mm-hmm. clients. So then it started to like breed into this just me being kind of ornery about wanting to, you know, right some wrongs, I guess, and then that advocacy piece, you know, that started to come together. And then I stayed in San Francisco and worked with different drug diversion courts and juvenile justice programs, and ended up starting a citywide program in San Francisco that helped folks getting out of prison and helped them with housing and healthcare, basic needs stuff, employment, things like that. And when I started working with that population, the youth and adults, it kind of was 18 and up at that point, the systems that they had to navigate was just unbelievable. The amount of systems, the magnitude of the systems, and the lack of clarity and just difficulty on figuring out what the hell you're supposed to do. And on top of that, a lot of people were sick. They were physically sick. They were mentally sick. You know, these people didn't feel good for a lot of reasons, and that just never really got addressed. Even early in my career, I didn't address it as much as I see now, how important it is. So, and then when it was identified that somebody, you know, really needed some mental health support or some, you know, medical help or something, then trying to navigate, again, that system of, you know, do you have insurance, yes or no? Who do you talk to? What if you don't? And then you have to renew it. And, you know, these people don't have permanent addresses. And, you know, the system was just flawed. So, you know, getting that really hands-on experience of, like, side-by-side with somebody trying to figure this out was like, this is really important work. In the here and now, it's important to – because the systems are not good. You know, they're broken. Some of them are designed to be that way. But and that needs to be addressed. But it's not going to be addressed overnight. So there's got to be support and energy around helping people in the current systems. So direct service was a thing that's been really important to me. But then that advocacy piece is huge too. Like, we should not have to be swimming upstream and spawning the way we do in current systems, right? We should be able to kind of remedy some of those things, and that's where advocacy comes into play. So I started this work with that and with kind of the two pillars of anybody who's in this work should do both. I do direct service. I don't have time for advocacy, or I'm a community organizer. Direct service is not, no. You've got to have some crossover, or at least you've got to communicate with both of those sides, because those are the two halves that make a whole. Anyhow, and then I ended up in Seattle. I moved to Seattle and started again working in juvenile justice type programs. I worked in transitional housing. And the health stuff really started coming up in transitional housing, mainly because of the environment. These kids lived there, and they could live there for up to 18 months. So we got to know each other. As the case manager that worked the swing shift and was there, you know, when they were home, and the kids that lived there, you know, you hang out in the office and you get to know folks.
This is part of youth care?
Part of
was
youth
that,
care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
This was at Home of Hope in with youth care. Which is really neat. A lot of medical stuff would come up, and you could also see more medical stuff mm-hmm. coming up because you saw kids at home sick, or you saw what kids were eating. You know, there was a McDonald's across the street, not good. or, you know, even more personal matters like promiscuous sex and, you know, whether or not they're safe. People using and struggling with, because it was a clean and sober house, but people struggling with that. So, and since you were kind of in their home, you saw what was going on in their home. And this was an area, a very large area, that was really, that has not really been addressed in housing programs and some treatment programs and, you know, different things. And then U District Street Medicine came up as an opportunity. And
so tell me more about that.
Yeah. So U District Street Medicine
has become your life.
Yeah. And that was not what I had expected. It's been wonderful, but not what I expected. So I was working at youth care still. Mm-hmm. And it was time for me to start doing my internship. I was full-time over there, and I was going, oh, my gosh, how am I going to do both?
And so you're back in social work school
yeah,
by then.
Yeah, okay. So school and, I'm at University of Washington getting my master's, and I'm working full-time. And then one of the School of Social Work listservs or something put out this blast email saying, in big capital letters, would you be interested in working with an interdisciplinary team on a homeless clinic? And I was like, that sounds kind of interesting, sure. You know, and it read through, like, you know, we're working with these schools. But it was very bare bones. I mean, it was like, there's three students and, you know, we want to model after Detroit Street Medicine and we're going to be interdisciplinary, and that's right. About all we know.
And that was about two years ago now?
Two years ago. Yeah, it was February of 2014, okay. Actually. And they had just started. I think they started in November of the prior year. So they were really in infancy. And so I responded to the email. I was like, that sounds cool. Let's see what that's about. Thinking that I was going to be one of many mm-hmm. social workers and other people. No. It was me. It was just one social worker and a social worker, two med students, a physical therapy student, and a nursing student. Mm-hmm. And that was it. And the first handful of meetings was, what are we doing? Should we be a registered student organization? Is that a thing? how do we want to go about this? Here's some research that we've done so far. And so I came in, and having been a social worker in the Seattle area for almost 3 years at that point, I had some contacts with different agencies, and I had worked in transitional housing and things, so I had worked with the homeless population right. at that point in Seattle for a few years. So I kind of chimed in and said, well, you know, I know a few people, and I could probably connect you to some people, and we can see what they're doing and how they're doing it and see if we can partner with them and all that, because that was really beneficial in San Francisco, having as many good partnerships as you could with people. Like, just the strength in numbers thing mm-hmm. was so important. It was like a rule in San Francisco that you had strength in numbers, which is a cool thing about San Francisco. but Seattle had a little bit of that, but not a lot. And these med students and the other students, they were all here for school. They weren't from Seattle. So when I offered that, they were like, oh, good, yes, please. Please do that. So started, you know, making partnerships and getting faculty advisors from all the different schools. So now for the last year and a half, I guess, we've been doing a lot of planning and a lot of outreach. We've done a couple of needs assessments with the population and with local service providers in the U District, community members, current and formerly homeless folks, to really find out what needed to be done. Like, what's out there now? What's working? What doesn't? What's the most important thing to you, when getting service? You know, like, let's ask the question of the people that we're trying to serve, because that's, in my mind, that's what we're doing. We're working with these people, and we're serving these people, because that's just the right thing to do. And so we got answers. I mean, people were very pleased to be spoken to with respect and genuine care. So we got answers, and they said, well, you know, literally and figuratively meet us where we're at in a physical space, meet us on the street, meet us at places that we're more comfortable with. We have a hard time coming to you medically. The clinics are intimidating. We don't get treated well. We don't get enough information. We don't have money to get all the way to Harborview or whatever. You know, there's logistical issues with this as well. And it was kind of this, you know, overarching ring to it of we're not trying to be lazy. We really want to get this taken care of, but things are bad. Things are bad for us. And it would help to remedy that. You know, there's things that we'd really like to remedy that, and then we'll meet you there. And I think that's a fair agreement. Mm-hmm. it doesn't feel one-sided on either side to be working with people saying, hey, we'll both meet in the middle. That's a square deal.
You come out of your clinics and your hospitals.
Yeah, like we'll come out and then you come and see us too. Like we'll come out of clinics and hospitals and we'll meet you where you're at and we'll get to know you. And, you know, you show up to the best of your capacity and we'll have a level of understanding of, you know, you might not show up every time mm-hmm. and we might not be able to give you something that you need, you know, but open communication, like let's build a relationship. Let's be fair about this. So that's really been a premise of this project is to have it be really community informed and community supported and also get information and support from people that are doing this work in the area. I've been a direct service social worker for almost 10 years and I've loved it, but I've also hated it. Because the direct service folks are the ones doing the work, but not getting any power in decision making mm-hmm. when it comes to how you work with people and different policies that are in place. So a lot of them are very disconnected. So a big personal charge for me in this project was to talk to service providers too. I mean, talk to administrators and, you know, folks that deal with administrative, that's important. But the direct service often gets overshadowed by grants and money and organizational stuff and partnerships, you know, and not talking to the people that are doing the work, I think is an error.
So when you say talking with a direct service provider, so also trying to see what they need and what they would envision that they need to do the job that they want to do?
It's kind of a like an alternate explanation in some ways or in a more detailed description of what we're hearing from homeless folks. Like, homeless folks are struggling to navigate these different systems, one, because the systems are difficult, and two, you know, there's possibly a lot of mental and physical issues, and just the condition of being homeless, you know, your primary focus isn't navigating the healthcare system, right? It's navigating a place to sleep and not get your shit stolen and things like that. But social work, like direct service social workers, that's their job. And but they're also met with the same frustrations. It's like a different version of frustration tolerance in a way. Like the social workers are the ones kind of pinch hitting for that person on, like, you know, dealing with probation, like translating probation to somebody or translating medical orders to somebody or explaining medication. You know, there's the day-to-day stuff. So social workers that are navigating that, you know, come up with the same issues of lack of funding and things like that. Like, I was at a meeting the other day, and they were talking about, you know, this next fiscal year and the different funding and all that. And they're like, we're going to have these flex dollars. And that's really exciting because you can, a case manager can kind of use them anywhere and for almost anything. It can be paying for parking tickets or getting a bus ticket out of here or interview clothes or whatever. And there's not as many strings attached on the money because, you know, the way grants are written, the money trickles down to, like, you have X amount of dollars to do this and these things don't qualify. You know, you can't buy food or you can't buy you can't pay for people's parking tickets. Meanwhile, sometimes those are the things that need to be cleared up the most because there's so many collateral effects to it. You know, if you live in your van and you have so many tickets that you're about to get booted and then you can't move your van and then you get more tickets because you can't move your van and then eventually it gets impounded, now you are sleeping in the alley. And you realize that you need to handle this, but you're living in your van and you're 72 years old and you're on Social Security and you can't work and you have a mental health condition. You know what I mean? So all of that stuff that comes together. So anyway, this funding or this funder was saying, you know, we have these flex dollars, so now you can use them for a larger breadth of things. And it was like, oh, yay. At first glance, that is huge. That has been a hurdle that social workers have had to deal with forever on going down these, you know, convoluted paths and then getting to the end of it and being like, oh, well, they do cover it or they will fund it, but they're out of money. And then we have to scramble next month with 300 other case managers to try to get that money. Or there's one permanent housing vacancy for the entire county. And it's probably not going to be the person I'm working with. You know what I mean? So then dealing with that. But like the flex dollars thing, I'm sorry, I keep going back and forth. The flex dollars thing, you know, that's a big deal. But then I asked him, I said, well, people say somebody needs to pay off parking tickets and get a new pair of shoes and pay for a GED test and go to the doctor and they need money for that or whatever, transportation. Do these flex dollars allow that person to go through one case manager or do they have to go to five different places for each individual issue? That's the social work frustration, right? So, and the answer that I got from that funder was, well, we really haven't figured that out yet. Uh-oh.
Yes.
That sounds ominous to a social worker. Like you have funds and you're announcing them, but you haven't figured that out yet. So that's another piece of this project too. And that's another reason, and that is the primary reason why we've really reached out to community agencies, you know, to find out what they do and how we can partner, but also what is working and what is not. Like, what are you running into? And then going back to our, you know, respective folks, our U District Street Med folks, and figuring out if there's ways we can do it for free or ways we can do it through someone else, you know, like how. Can we make this more streamlined? Sometimes we can't, but sometimes we can. And so, you know, that's kind of an ongoing piece of this project too and an ongoing kind of fun and fascinating challenge that I hope stays with it.
Right. So kind of filling in some of the gaps
that
you're seeing from the needs assessment, from talking with the people themselves that are experiencing homelessness and health issues, and then also their support people, their direct service providers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
Because that's that's when it goes right, that's a team.
Right.
You know, you should be working together fairly closely. And, you know, and that's another thing that's difficult with, you know, case management or, you know, on any spectrum, medical, et cetera. Your caseloads are huge and there's one of you. And so another purpose of U District Street Medicine is to kind of be a training ground for people. Mm-hmm. It's a place where it's an educational thing. You know, we teach there and we learn there too. Because I figure that because I went back to grad school because I wanted to teach. Like I wanted to go, you know, I wanted to be a lecturer and I still kind of do. Mm-hmm. But because I figured, you know, if people are in an educational setting, in an academic setting, they're there to learn. And especially when you get into master's level and things like that, you're there to learn your craft, right? You're there to learn what you're going to do, what you want to do, mm-hmm. ideally, right? So if you're getting the tools there and you're getting the, you know, solid tools there and there's a class of 20 people and out of those 20 people, 5 people get it, 2 people get it. Ideally, all 20 would get it, but, you know, let's be reasonable, mm-hmm. right? So say 5 people. Now you have 5 more people out there doing this and doing it well and doing it right. And then U District Street Medicine is great with that because we have so many different disciplines. We have medicine, we have nursing, social work, dentistry, physical therapy, pharmacy, almost public health,
almost.
and the School of Law. So now
– that's huge.
Yeah. So then if you get 5 people from school social work, that's great. But if you get 5 people from all of those different schools, that's a lot of people that are out there doing it right and getting it. And fortunately, that's been a lot of feedback that we've gotten with U District Street Medicine is it's kind of changed my career path. You know, now I want to work in community health. I'm more interested in community health. I get it now. This is something I want to advocate for. Now I feel more comfortable in my neighborhood with homeless people around because it's not a big deal. You know, so there's a lot of really cool educational things happening in there. And it's people that are learning by doing. What a great thing. What a great right. thing to do it. Especially in an environment where you have an incredible amount of support. You have faculty advisors. You have other students. You have people that have been doing this for 30 years. You have people that have been doing it for 3 days and already love it. Right. You know, it's great. It's just really good energy in there.
Nice. And yeah. you also have some people like Kelson who help to run
navigate. Oh my gosh,
the
yes,
administration.
Kelson. Let me put on record that Kelson Caldwell has been absolutely amazing in navigating some pretty bureaucratic stuff. That is not my highest skill set.
Mm-hmm. Kelson, I will have him on an interview as well.
Oh, good. Yes. Wonderful. Because there's, you know, it's – and that's been a learning experience for me, I think for everybody, especially for me. I will speak for me. You can't just have a good idea and some information. It's good to have those two things. Good idea, support, and information is great. That's a good foundation to have, with some research sprinkled on top. But that's not where it ends. You then have to move all these, not even mountains, glaciers. You just have to move these glaciers with stuff that you can't see underneath and. The top will move and then the bottom won't and then it'll shift back and it's like, oh my gosh. So the bureaucracy of it, of all of the tiny little webs that have to do with that this thing has, and then navigating the liability, that is a system that I am very new to and am struggling with a lot. And Kelson has just been doing it with patience and grace.
Yes. Yeah, that is huge. I like glaciers, and probably not the melting kind either.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so tell me, because I know a lot. I mean, just the good idea. You know, you being in there, bringing the social work, the systems kind of level thinking, community thinking, it's been a lot. But I know you all have just started kind of getting it off the ground. So can you tell me some of what you're doing?
Yeah.
Like now?
Yeah. Last week was week six of outreach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's exciting. We have two community-based sites. One of them is Elizabeth Gregory Day Home, which is out of University Lutheran Church here in Seattle in the U District. And then we have Blessed Sacrament, which is St. Vincent de Paul, but the Catholic Church up on 9th. So we go to those two sites once a month and work with folks there. We have two different populations there. Elizabeth Gregory is women only. It's a women's day center. So women and then anyone who identifies as a woman is welcome there. And we liked that because it was a safe space for women, which is a nice thing to have when you're homeless. And Elizabeth Gregory Home has just – they've been so welcoming and wonderful, so forever grateful. And then Blessed Sacrament, St. Vincent de Paul at Blessed Sacrament, they do a Sunday dinner every Sunday, and they see a lot of people. They see 300 to 400 people every Sunday.
Yeah.
And typically it's 18 and up and then, you know, minors with parents and things with no eligibility criteria. You know, come as you are, come have a meal. But the majority of their folks are older. And
by older, what do you mean?
It ranges 40 and up.
Yeah,
40 to 70s, some.
Right.
And the U District, it has a lot of youth resources and services and things like that, which is wonderful. But our older folks that sort of age out of the youth system at either 24 or 25, depending on the grant, they're kind of stuck with a lot less resources right in the general area. They can have a hot meal in the U District twice a week, and that's it. The rest is going downtown. And then other kind of basic services are pretty limited here. So we went with Blessed Sacrament because one of our primary focus is the folks that have aged out of the youth system, because that was identified as a gap in service. And then we do street outreach twice a week, again, based on the feedback that we got from service providers and homeless folks. You know, we're out on the Ave. We're over at Gorilla Park. We are at the library, you know, because we're allowed to be there and we don't get harassed there or things like that. So, yeah, it'd be great to talk to somebody.
the public there. Library you're talking
public
about,
library, yeah. The public there on Roosevelt.
Right.
And so then we go out in teams. We have – when we do street outreach, we do either 2 to 3 teams because it takes about 3 teams to hit the entire U in one outreach shift, which is like 2 hours. So we have 2 or 3 teams with 2 or 3 students and a preceptor who – supervises those students and whatever interactions they have. And we kind of have divided the U District up into zones. So we have sort of a northern end with Ravenna Park and the library, Gorilla Park, or University Playground. This is kind of the Roosevelt area because there's a decent group of folks up there. And then we have another zone that's down on Boat Street, where there's a lot of van camping and RV camping and things like that, people living down there. And Burt Gilman is also through that part. And then we have the Ave and kind of the surrounding alleys and areas, mainly up to 16th, 17th is pretty much where we go. So with 3 teams, we can cover that. And we go out. Right now, we're in the very initial stages, so a lot of it is just a slow rollout of this is who we are, and this is what we're doing, and this is what we're planning on doing. You know, give us some feedback on what would be helpful once we really get going. We figured that'd be a good idea because that relationship building is important.
So do you give out any health-related supplies?
We can navigate resources and things like that. Like if somebody says, you know, I got in a fight the other day and, you know, my ribs are kind of sore. Mm-hmm. You know, we can ask them things like, you know, do you have insurance? And then if they don't, navigate them to how to do that and who, and ideally connect with someone at, you know, that place.
Mm-hmm.
or, oh, you have insurance, you know, do you have a primary care doctor, yes or no? So then you just kind of do the question tree and see what the next step is. So we're able to do that now. We're still really early in outreach, so a lot of it is just relationship building of, like, us becoming familiar and us remembering names and faces and things like that before we get too personal. But it's already starting to happen a little bit. Like, people are already starting to ask questions about navigating certain things, which is great. That shows that, you know, we're building some rapport quickly, which is good. So that's, yeah, we – and then we have different resources of you know, hot meals, and we have our little bag of tricks and can can pass that stuff out.
What's in the bag of tricks?
We've got – well, we just got a tablet.
Oh, yay.
Yay. So we can get on the internet right then and there and, you know, if there's anything that needs to be done online. We have flyers for different, you know, things that – different services that are sort of in the area. We have connections with NeighborCare, the 45th Street Clinic. Mm-hmm. So if push comes to shove – we haven't had to use them, but if push comes to shove, we can try to get somebody into – you know, ideally a next day appointment if it's not anything serious. And then we also just have protocol for if there is something serious, we need to get them to UW or Harborview or Swedish or whatever their situation is. And we also have outreach supplies, stuff like socks, reusable water bottles.
Sunscreen.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, actually, sunscreen. We should put that on the list now.
Yes.
Yeah, some of the stuff that came up as common, we've got feminine hygiene products because that was one. They're like, we get enough toothbrushes and toothpaste elsewhere, teeth and toes and different things. They're like, we got that. But, you know, feminine hygiene products and underwear and socks and gauze, you know, or just a box of Band-Aids. Like, we need stuff like that. That would be really helpful. So that's sort of in our bag of tricks, too, on being able to have some tangible stuff that people need, especially socks. My gosh,
yeah,
you cannot get enough socks.
Cannot
get enough socks. So we're doing outreach that way, and then we're going to start being able to do blood pressure readings and things while we're out. The law students will be able to come in and sort of untangle different processes like parking tickets and probation and things like that on a general sense of
– or even healthcare rights.
Who to talk to. Healthcare rights, yeah. All of that stuff. And they'll actually be doing some larger scale stuff with – they'll do like medical legal partnerships on – navigating those respective things. But then we're hoping to get – we're planning and hoping to get clinic space eventually in the U District. Where to be determined, we've had a lot of great opportunities come up that we're definitely happy about and looking into. But ideally, you know, we want a space in the U that we'd be able to operate on – alternate hours and alternate days and with, you know, the homeless population, but again, really focusing on 25 and up.
Right.
Yeah.
Nice. So in terms of is because now you've worked with kind of within systems in two major West Coast cities, San Francisco and now Seattle. What would you say – and I know it was a little different in terms of what you were doing in San Francisco. But what would you say in terms of your perception of differences and similarities, especially in terms of charity healthcare between the two places?
Sure. San Francisco, going back to that partnership thing – San Francisco, maybe because of its, you know, radical protest, you know, storming City Hall mentality that it's always had, they really do the strength in numbers things there. And I mean, there's hierarchy there as well. There's universities and then San Francisco General Hospital and then bigger nonprofits and then smaller nonprofits. So there's, you know, I mean, it's not all even, but but still the importance of, you know, kind of the big guys partnering with the little guys and the city and county partnering with nonprofits. That's a thing there that's really just predominant in San Francisco. One example that they have there is they have what's called the San Francisco Hot Team, or the homeless outreach team, that has been around in San Francisco for years. It should get more credit, in my opinion, but maybe it's – the vibe in San Francisco is that this kind of work is such a natural right thing to do that it's there's not a lot of pomp and circumstance. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of fluff with it. It's just like, well, this is the work we need to do, so this is what we're going to do without a lot of fanfare. And they've been around for a while, so it's just kind of a San Francisco institution to have the San Francisco Hot Team, homeless outreach team. And what that is it's through the city and county of San Francisco. I want to say their Department of Health there. I can't remember if it's Public Health or Department of Health. But so it's a city and county funded entity, and it employs formerly homeless folks. And they have a van, and they go around all over San Francisco and find people. San Francisco has a large homeless population, a lot of mental health issues, a lot of substance abuse, and with it being a small city geographically, there are really big hot spots, like the Tenderloin mm-hmm. and Hunters Point and parts of the Mission and south of Market. You know, there's some real big hot spots that are sort of fraught with some big medical and mental health needs constantly. So what they'll do is if they've got someone who's, you know, struggling with some mental health symptoms or they're incredibly intoxicated or high and they're becoming a bit of a public nuisance, instead of calling the cops first, a lot of times they will call the homeless outreach team, and that team will go out and see if they can remedy the situation. Whether it means just talking to the guy and calming him down, you know, getting him into detox, because they have detox there. That helps. Mm-hmm. You know, getting him into a shelter for a night or getting him to the hospital or whatever. And it's a nice little stopgap because the cops can oftentimes lead to an arrest, which that's their job, but it's an inappropriate arrest. Right. Yeah, it's an inappropriate arrest. And if you've got presenting medical or mental issues, those have got to come first before incarceration. And the fact that it's staffed by formerly homeless folks just makes sense because they get it mm-hmm. and they know how to talk to somebody and work with somebody. You know, it's not based on fear or restoring order or anything like that. It's about, we've got a situation here, let's deal with it. So that's a little different there.
Well, Seattle has a hot team as well, but I think maybe what I'm hearing from you as a difference is they really stick to downtown.
Yeah.
The hot team. And yeah. Also, I'm not sure that they have the same emphasis on hiring formerly homeless individuals.
Yeah. See, that I don't know. Yeah. Because I know the Rescue Mission comes out and they do outreach supplies and a little bit of navigating and things like that. And then downtown.
Mm-hmm. But they don't come up to the U district.
But they don't come
like
to the U. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, certainly not just downtown in the U here.
they
could really cover some ground. I get why they don't, but they could really cover mm-hmm. some ground. So there's that. And then as far, I mean, there's a few, you know, the UCSF is there and mm-hmm. A couple other, you know, pretty heavy research and practice schools there in the Bay Area for medicine that, you know, have had systems implemented for a long time. I don't see much difference between Seattle and San Francisco in regards to that. They have community health clinics as well. But they're in the same situation as Seattle in that they're constantly on the chopping block and they're, you know, they're over capacity.
Right.
You know, they've got the same issues that we do and a lot of the same model as we do as well. Yeah, that's That's about all the differences I can think of. We're pretty similar, actually. we are actually, and we're getting more similar to San Francisco in that our population is getting bigger. That was a difference between San Francisco and Seattle, is the population was so much larger in San Francisco.
Of homeless population?
Of the homeless population.
Right.
Yeah, the homeless population. And, you know, so they've had that resource shortage for a long time, mm-hmm. like painfully so. But also, I mean, I guess another difference is they have a lot more detox and substance abuse treatment there.
Which goes with their history.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Right. Hate Ashbury left a mark.
What do you do with a drunken sailor?
Right. Yeah. I mean, we've got Barbary Coast. We've got Hate Ashbury. Yeah. They've got that thing down. So there's that, which is nice. That mm-hmm. is a difference between the two. And then they have their AIDS work and LGBTQ mm-hmm. work is something.
Is a real model.
Yeah. And I mean, they were really at the forefront for mm-hmm. Respite care for people dying of AIDS. And then advocating against mm-hmm. the stigma of AIDS, they did a lot of great work there. Right. And it still resonates. I mean, those are still LGBTQ and HIV AIDS and substance abuse are like three big focuses, mm-hmm. Big priorities in San Francisco.
Right.
And not so much here. There's some, but and we're getting there.
Yeah.
But I am the lack of treatment services here is concerning.
Right. And I hear that from a lot of people. So that kind of leads me to another question. What keeps you from burning out? Like, what do you do in terms of burnout prevention?
Sure.
And especially like you are pointing out, just keeping an eye on our time,
sure.
too, for your benefit as well. But in terms of your passion for teaching as well. So, like, what would you – and what do you tell students coming up that are younger about burnout prevention?
Yeah, right. Because it is not all doom and gloom. It's actually wonderful. Well, it might sound kind of, I don't know, hippie of me or something, but I kind of boil it down on a foundational level of like energy in and energy out. I put a lot of energy into what I do because I get a lot of energy out of it, positive mm-hmm. energy. And I get that positive energy back when we get through a bureaucratic hurdle or you see people coming together and working, you know, oh, we have a problem. Let's dive in and fix, you know, people having their own energy and motivation, people learning, seeing those light bulb moments or getting really good questions, either just general questions or why are we, you know, or advocacy questions. Why are we doing it that way? You know, seeing people thinking and doing and getting kind of down and dirty with it. And then meeting people that, like some of the homeless folks that I have met have just been amazing people.
There's stories.
And we've got some amazing musicians, some really wonderful artists. We've got brilliant thinkers, really well-read folks. I mean, the breadth of knowledge and personality and different types of people that you get to meet kind of across the board in work like this. I mean, people that have been huge, you know, storming City Hall advocates forever, people that are just an amazing keyboard player and they happen to do meth every day, you know, people that are learning their craft and then finding out that this is really what they want to do. That's huge. You know, that's all just amazing positive energy that I get back. And all I have to do is put it back out. So I'm never depleted because it's energy in and energy out. If it gets to a point where I'm starting to feel depleted, because that happens. You don't get past that bureaucratic hurdle. Mm-hmm. Something goes wrong. You don't feel good. There's something, you know, you're strapped for time, whatever. I mean, it's not always, you know, wine and roses. But if I start getting energy depleted, then I'm seeing that. You know, I'm getting better at recognizing that. And then finding strength in something away from that. I do a lot of photography. And
I've seen some of it. It's beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. I put a lot of energy into that. And it's like, it's funny, when I'm depleted, I go and put energy into that even though I don't have a lot. And it comes out really nicely, right? Because mm-hmm. then I get that energy back of, wow, that was a cool shot. Ooh, that worked. You know, it's a tangible thing. And then other people get to enjoy it, and I appreciate that as well. Because photography is, like, I do street photography, so I have to go out and do that. And it's a great way to drag myself out, because burnout, a lot of times for me and other folks that work in this field, we deal with people all day on many different levels. And sometimes when you get burnt out, you don't want to deal with people. And I tend to isolate, and that's not good. It's not really good for anybody for mm-hmm. long periods of time based on that. So photography forces me to go out. But I'm behind a camera, so I'm interacting, but I'm not.
You have that, right. You have a little bit of a bubble.
A little bit of a bubble, yeah. You know, I'm not having to talk and think and do, but I'm still out there, and I'm capturing some pretty cool stuff. And then strength in your friends and your colleagues. That's something that I have learned through the U District Street Medicine process. Like, if you're frustrated or stuck or you don't have the answer or you want to cry, go ahead. Find your faculty advisor or find your, you know, practicum advisor, your favorite, you know, whatever. Like, Dr. Dobie is one of mine. Yeah. And Nancy Almade is one of mine.
Right.
So being able to just kind of go to them and, you know, let them untangle it for a while is kind of nice. That's a good way to decompress. So just not being an island mm-hmm. is really important, too, for getting away from the burnout
right.
thing.
So being able to ask for help.
Yes. Yeah. My first boss in social services, I worked at a community mental health clinic in Idaho, actually. I forgot about that 2 years in Idaho. Whoops. And it was a pretty intense job. I mean, you made like $12 an hour and it was billable hours. So you actually worked for like 60 hours a week, but you maybe got paid for 35. You were driving severely mentally ill people around in your car and, you know, in the community and things like that. And there was a lot of positives to it, but it was a tough job. Mm-hmm. And that was my first social work job. Intense. It was intense. And I struggled with it. I would isolate, and I would isolate at work and not reach out for help, and then I would get more frustrated. And my first boss there, she was amazing. I'm actually just forever grateful that I had that as my foundation, that particular agency, because they just did solid work, and they really modeled what a good agency should look like.
Nice.
So that was a great way to cut my teeth there right. instead of one that was not so much, because I've worked at a few of those. But she said, no, nobody is an island, so don't even try. And when she said, and that's so simple because it's so true, right. but it was like, wow, mind exploded. Yeah, I guess so. And even though it resonated then, and that was, gosh, when did I start there? 2006? It still took me years to really understand what that meant. And it still does. And that's another thing with burnout. You are going to get burnt out every once in a while, and that's okay. It's not every time you burn out or have a day where you're just like, oh, the hell with it. I can't do it. Or you take the next day off as a mental health day. Don't beat yourself up about it. It's okay.
Right.
It's okay. If you had a really, really crappy day on Monday, for whatever reason, and work sucked, and you called in sick on Tuesday because you just couldn't do it, if you go back on Wednesday, you're okay. Take that time.
Right. And it means that you're actually feeling something.
Yeah.
Sociopaths don't burn out, right?
Yes, right.
They don't.
Right. Yeah. It's a little bit of burnout is okay.
Right. That means.
Yeah.
So the last question I have for you, you've addressed some of it, but like what would you say some of your biggest hopes are for the future in terms of kind of safety net healthcare in the Seattle area in King County?
Well, we need more treatment beds, and we need, I mean, substance abuse treatment is, there's not a lot here. We have some harm reduction measures here. We have needle exchanges and in different places like Lifelong AIDS Alliance for, you know, safe sex. I mean, there are some harm reduction pieces into play.
In the 1811 building.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in 1811, right. And then community clinics that are, you know, like Nyer Ernest House and having mm-hmm. the clinic right there. That's great. More of that. More of that is important, I think, for not just the here and now, but as things go on. As you probably can tell by now, I'm a bit of a systems person. So the structure of those places, I mean, we need more community buy-in with that, right? I think Seattle has done kind of an okay job of convincing people mm-hmm. that 1811 is and Nyer Ernest are good things. But there's still a lot of miseducation or lack of education around what 1811 does and places like that. Like an article came out in the Times a few weeks ago saying that since Nyer Ernest House has been in Ballard, 911 calls have been up 411% mm-hmm. or something. Okay, that makes sense because that lot used to be a parking lot. Anything is 100% more, right? So, you know, so that miseducation again and that lack of education around what, you know, we don't on a higher level, you know, on a state level and on a county level, we don't have a lot of support for those kind of services. And that's problematic. So advocacy around that. And then having more services like that when people are, you know, struggling really hard with substances and things where there's not a lot of places you can send them right now where they can get stabilized somewhat. Interdisciplinary teams, I think that's kind of my thing.
Right.
Interdisciplinary in medical, I think, is really important. Like what U District Street Medicine does, mm-hmm. you know, knowing what a nurse does and knowing what a doctor does and knowing what a social worker does is important. But then putting that in practice is actually talking to each other. If you have the same patient that's coming through multiple systems but coming across the same people for the same issues, all of those providers have the same information but different information, and they all have different lenses. So I think a focus, you know, at University of Washington and then Seattle as a whole on interdisciplinary teams medically would be really important.
And then, as you mentioned, maybe expanding the hot team.
And expanding the hot team. Yeah, expanding the hot team because they are they're great.
They're pretty awesome.
They're awesome.
Yeah.
And I think expanding the even the geographical locations of different housing programs and treatment options and social service agencies. Seattle tends to be, you know, really condensed with youth services in the U and really condensed with adult services in Pioneer Square because those mm-hmm. have been the quote-unquote traditional mm-hmm. areas that people sort of reside. But that, I don't know if that has ever really been entirely true, but it's also shifting a little bit because the ones, the Vietnam vets and the youth of the U district are now in their 60s and 70s and they're still in the U.
Mm-hmm.
So having very kind of siloed, concentrated areas of youth services and adult services is makes it difficult for folks to either they just don't have as many options.
Right, and people like to stay in the neighborhood that they're is their neighborhood, it's their community.
Yeah, or you know, and having to go downtown is it can be really difficult.
Right,
And I think, I mean, it's healthcare, it's healthcare. I'm like, it's healthcare per se, but no, it's healthcare. Again, 1811, housing first, and housing with the medical model in it has, I mean, research has shown it to work, and 1811 has shown it to work. I mean, giving a stable place to stay without any strings attached then opens up the opportunity to address some of the larger issues. If somebody is transient and you can't find them and you spend the majority of your time trying to find them, it's inefficient use of resources and time, and that person gets progressively worse health-wise, either medically or mental health-wise, just based on the instability and then not getting the access to care. So I would love to see Seattle. I mean, this is a big pipe dream, I guess, but I would love to see Seattle do a lot of housing first stuff where people are housed and the medical stuff is either within or very close. 'Cause those are basic needs. I mean, I guess it boils down to, you know, let's address basic needs, which is eating, being sound medically, being sound mentally, and being safe.
Being safe.
Yeah.
Right.
Being safe.
That's huge.
Yeah.
So anything else that you wanted to say, anything that I didn't ask you that you wished I had at all, or...
I don't think so. I talked a lot.
I
hope it
great.
Was useful.
No,
yeah.
It definitely is. Good. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah.
And I'm very impressed with all of the work that you're doing, including your teaching.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Thank you.